Sheffield Live. Made in Sheffield, made by you.
Wake up to something different on Sunday mornings by joining me, Pete Evans, for Spinning Jazz. The finest in modern jazz, from hard bop to bossa nova, from Latin to soul. That's Spinning Jazz every Sunday morning at 9 on Sheffield Live. 93.2 FM.
If you like rock in all its forms, you will love Glory Days. You can listen to us locally on 93.2 FM and on the telly, and anywhere in the world on sheffieldlive.org. What do you think, Don? You know what? I think he likes it. That's Glory Days, every Monday 1 till 3, here on Sheffield Live. Bosh, bosh. Oops, I've had an accident.
Hello, I'm Harry Wilburn. I present Steel & Wire every Wednesday, 10 a.m. Americana, bluegrass, American roots, and more. Lots of guests, lots of local music and musicians. That's Steel & Wire, Wednesday, 10 a.m.
You are listening to fabulous Harry Wilburn on Steel & Wire.
It's time to open the music box. Join me, Steve Roden, every Thursday morning between 10 and 12 for music from the 40s to the 90s from my own music collection. Songs I've grown up with, ones I am sure you will enjoy hearing again. Hope to see you then.
If you love new music and you want to discover the best new artists out there, then tune into The Backroom with me, Paddy. I'll be playing the best of new indie, electro, EDM and punk, and showcasing new Sheffield talent. Also music news, local and national gig guide and new album releases. So tune into The Backroom every Thursday night between 6 and 7 p.m. here on Sheffield Live, 93.2 FM.
This is Sheffield Live.
I'm Martin, and this is the film show on Sheffield Live. We're back. First off, apologies for ruining thousands of people's Saturdays last week for a show not going out.
Yeah, I got a text.
Did you? there was throngs of people outside the studio this morning when we come in with flowers and well wishings, and it was me. I was feeling very, very ill, and it was very late on before we could put a substitute show together. So today's show is going to be a bit of a mix-up between bits that we were going to do last week.
Catching up.
Some bits that we're actually going to have to put off until next week. And our interview with Rob Younger at the Parkway Cinema, Barnsley.
Your favourite cinema.
Oh, I could tell you, I nearly cried when I was there. I'll tell you that later on. Anyway, But first off, you're going to tell us all about EastEnders.
Well, I'm not going to tell you all about EastEnders.
Yeah, what do you know about EastEnders then, eh?
40 years. You ain't my mother.
Yes, get out of my pub.
See, you know it. You poo-poo it. But I'm an EastEnders watcher. And it was a big week this week for EastEnders.
All kind of says, I don't watch it. I lived it.
You lived it. Well, that's the thing. I don't think anyone lives the life...
I can assure you, they don't.
On that screen anymore, and I don't think that really matters. No one lives like Coronation Street. No one lives like Albert Square.
Don't they?
They don't, babes. They don't. But, however, I still find it. I still watch it. My mum used to watch all the soaps. I suppose it depends. Your relationship with soaps depends on the household you grew up in, doesn't it, really? My mum watched all the soaps apart from Coronation Street. Literally everything else she watched. Mm. And the only thing that stayed with me watching was EastEnders. So I've watched it on and off for the 40 years it's been on. And it seems like they're trying to do what they can. They've recently got a new studio, got a new filming. They've spent a lot of money
on their new Albert Square, haven't they? Yeah.
But the viewing figures are never going to be what they were. Like 30 million people watched Ange and Den on that Christmas.
But it's like
episode.
It for all soaps now. And also
yeah,
that
and
thing
like
where.
It's like television, yeah, broadcast television.
If you think about stories about soap actors, used to be on the front page of the Mirror, the Sun, the Star, yeah, all week, every week, didn't it, you know?
But I still. I've had time off for good behaviour. Mm. But the good thing about EastEnders for me used to be that Sunday omnibus. Because it was the perfect thing when I was in my 20s for the hangover, laying around all day watching other people being miserable. Although it's not always miserable. There's quite a lot of humour in it as well. And because it's long drama, these characters, you get to know them and grow with them. So actually, this week's 40th anniversary episodes, they've chucked everything at it.
Yeah.
Blew up the Queen Vic, pretty much.
Again.
Yeah, but like... They've obviously gone, well, we've had a fire there before, so it's got to be a bit more. I'm not sure as well, like, reality has to be belief suspended and all that kind of stuff because, you know, the only people that could get into this building were not the professional fire service and the ambulance. It was a woman who'd been locked up in a lock-up for 3 months, was the only one that was able to break in and help her half-sister have a baby live on air. So they did a live episode.
You're reminding me why I don't watch
EastEnders. Do you know, but then they killed off a character that was... In the first episode, he was... it was announced that Pauline Fowler was pregnant, so Martin Fowler, who became that baby... has been in and out of the show as a greengrocer on his stall for 40 years. He's dead. Died in a heartbreaking way where obviously the love of his life comes with him and he saves her life. And it's all very high drama. But I really, really liked it. But it was live television. Why do it live? They've done it about 3 times now.
I think every most of the big soaps have done that, and it was a special.
But no mistakes really in this one. Yeah. It was so now the conspiracy is well must have been recorded then.
Well, if you really want to spend a lot of brain cells on wondering what the conspiracy
is, Chris Clenshaw, who's the producer, he's going soon. And he's the one that's putting
in
all
I've no idea who these people are.
I'm
glad you haven't started talking about the cast.
Well, but he did this storyline last year, which was a flash forward to Christmas, where there were 6 characters with a dead body. And then it becomes the rest of the year leading up to that Christmas was like a whodunit and who was it.
So like time travel in EastEnders, this is it.
Well, they also brought back a dead character. And it's not the first time they've done
that.
Well,
we'll say
either,
this.
Is they've had, well, no, as in dead, an image of a ghost kind of thing. So they've had Pat Butcher before when Peggy was coming near to the end of her life. And this one, Sharon's mum, Anita Dobson, who was only in the show for like 3 years.
Mrs. Brian May.
Mrs. Brian May. She appears as a, come on, Sharon, scream, shout, get some help. It's... It was all there, and then someone had a baby and they named it Julia, who is, of course, the original writer of the show. It was all very high drama.
Can we stop talking about it now?
I enjoyed it. I loved
it. I'm glad you did, but this
I'm
is...
I'm not a secret EastEnders watcher.
Do you know the name of this show?
The film show.
Thank you.
Oh, yeah, but wait.
We're moving on.
William Shatner and Star Trek.
No, it's Shatner's legacy.
I just thought it was an interesting thing for the BBC to do as well.
Okay.
Trying to keep
Can
it going.
Get on to something else. Yeah, we've got a lot to get
we've
through
got
today.
15 minutes of something, haven't we?
Yes, but we've got to do. I want us to give enough time to wrap up the Mike Lee thing that we had to. And I don't
we've
want
got
us
some
to sort of
music from Mike
canter
Lee,
through that and. Yeah. While you're still droning on about...
Oh, shut your cake hole.
Peggy and Doc Cotton.
Shut your cake hole. Get out of my pub.
You're barred. Right. Sorry for that interruption there from our TV sponsors. Right. Mike Lee.
Mike Lee?
Yes. We sort of left it in midair, didn't we?
We did. So we talked a lot about the TV work and some of the early film work, but... We didn't talk a lot about some of those films. What should we start with?
This is your...
This is me?
This is your but Nicola Woods.
I've just banged on about EastEnders.
Well, then maybe you should have banged on a little bit less, knowing you had to have your Mike Lee stuff.
What's the first bit of music we're going to hear?
Life is Sweet.
Ah, I rewatched that the other week. So yeah. Because we've been like looking at it for 3 weeks, I've had three solid weeks of Mike Lee. And I found, I don't know about you, but going back to it with older eyes than when I first saw it, sometimes some of the characters in it when I first saw it felt annoying or like I didn't understand them necessarily. And now going back to it again, like Timothy Spall in Life is Sweet is that the friend of the family who is setting up a ridiculous restaurant.
And Mike Lee says that they talk to a chef to say that this menu he's creating, is it all actually possible? And some of them like say, no, that just you wouldn't be able to cook that. But some of them were viable.
Yeah, they came up with that in improv. But like that character, when I first encountered him, I was like, oh God, he's so annoying. How can... But that scene when he gets drunk at the restaurant, because obviously nobody comes because he hasn't marketed it and the food is abysmal, the idea of it. And he makes an unsuccessful pass at Alison Steadman and it's just really, really awkward and horrible. But he's a fascinating character when I watch it again.
I think you find even the characters that on the face of it are intensely dislikable. Most of them get a moment where you can see that they are human beings as well. And, you know, they're not entirely painted black. There's always a vestige of humanity to them, however small that might be.
Jane Horrocks as one of the sisters... So Claire Skinner is a sort of more tomboyish sister who's got it all together. And they don't seem like they're close at all. And Jane Horrocks is suffering with bulimia and all sorts of anxieties. And even those characters, I found when I came to watch it again, I just felt so much warmth for them more than I did before. And that was, of course, the first film that Dick Pope was the...
Yes, and Dick Pope's sadly passed away last October.
Mm. So Hard Truths was his last.
Was film. His Mike Lee's cinematographer throughout that period? Is this where I bring in my Mike Lee story now?
I probably need to
because because one of Lee's later films, Mr. Turner with Timothy Spall. He's like. His film biography of the painter J.W. Turner. I was an extra in it. Or should I say a background artiste?
Yes.
In the big scene where he puts the red dot on the painting. But it was quite fascinating I was fascinated watching Dick Pope work because this scene we did, it was all done in one long continuous shot. And you don't almost like quite associate that sort of cinema with Lee. You're going to be a camera stuck in a room. And I think sometimes you don't realise just how much visual effect there is in his films. But it was watching, because you were in this room they'd mocked up inside this big stately home, but it wasn't an actual room. It was all made up of green felt and balsa wood. Each of these shots would take about 2 minutes. So we did it about 8 or 9 times to get it perfectly
right.
Is
this right. The one where it's an exhibition?
Yes, yeah. It's all the new paintings that all the painters are bringing in, and they put the... It's supposed to be in the Royal Academy. And and the camera follows him around, talking to different artists. He doesn't talk to me, but he walks by me a few times, and I'm going, hello, Mum. And I'd be, before they'd do each other, they'd sort of do all this smoke and all that, they'd put out. You say, well, what's that for? And you're also standing there thinking, this looks really crap, this. This is going to look terrible. But that is the magic of cinema, you know, cinematography, lighting. And when you see it now, you think, God, that looks fabulous, that set, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
It's really strange.
They're magicians, aren't they?
It is. And it's just so strange how, and especially when you're shooting with film, you know, you can create something that looks so much better than what it does in real life. Mm. But I was there about 3 days. We were working on this scene, and it was just fascinating watching it work, watching Lee work and watching the mechanics of doing a scene like that. There must have been about 30 or 40 extras in the shot. It was a really, really great experience seeing him work.
Whereabouts was that again?
Is it Wentworth Woodhouse, that was?
Oh, yeah.
I'll tell you what, the food was good. Oh, the caterers. You never went hungry.
It's one of the most important jobs on a film set, isn't it, feeding everybody? Well, I saw Another Year last night as well. Have you seen that one from 2010?
No, but I want to watch that, because it was something about the cinematography in that. They divide it into seasons, and it's got a different look for each season.
It's kind of bleached the whole look of it. But it's another one of those stories. Actually, the couple in it is Ruth Sheen and Jim Broadbent, and they play, wait for it, Tom and Jerry. and they are... together, they're a together couple. They're sort of coming towards the end of their professional lives, got very successful careers, but they seem to be sort of, they open their house to people, they go off to the allotment, they live their time together, they're very happy, they're very cozy, but they have this orbit of friends around them who aren't quite so successful or lucky in love. They haven't met that person, they haven't found the career for them, and one of them is Leslie Manville as Mary. And she is a colleague of Ruth Sheen. Now, that was me pinging, was it?
That was me. Oh. A pung.
But when I saw it before, I was like, oh my God, their friend Mary's so annoying. And again, when I watched it just last night, I was like, oh my God, Mary, she's breaking my heart, this character. And actually, when you hear the actors talk about their characters in the film, like Ruth Sheen and Jim Broadbent are saying, you know, they're open and they're loving and they have this open house. And I'm like, and I think a lot of people responded to them like this as well. They're sneering. They're not nice to Mary.
Yeah.
They talk about her behind her back.
They're quite honest, smug about how good their lives are. Yeah.
About how they feel about her.
Yeah.
And they ridicule her. And why aren't they surrounded by lots of other successful people? Why have they... Yeah, I really, really enjoyed watching that last night. I'll lend you the...
Next week, yes, because I will watch it if you lend it to me. So, I suppose we have to sort of bring this to an end now, don't we? However, I mean, I think it's been great rediscovering these films, and I still haven't seen Hard Truths yet, so I've got that to catch up with. So, I've got that to look forward to. But, yes, I think... You also don't quite realise just how world-renowned he is, Lee. You know, in international cinema, he's seen as, you know, one of the great British film directors.
It's what, a 50-year career?
Yeah. And as I said just a little bit earlier, you don't quite realise how visual his films are.
Mm.
And you've really have to just sometimes step back and, like, appreciate how subtle. So I was reading about All or Nothing, which was a film I never really liked.
I watched it this week and I liked it more than I expected.
Yeah,
to,
but they said there, you know, people were telling me, oh, whatever you do, don't go and shoot on an estate. It's going to be a nightmare. Yeah.
Well, but it was an estate.
They found
his
estate that had just been
down,
cleared,
wasn't it?
And so yeah. It was completely empty. Yeah. And when you look at it now, it's got a certainly it's got an unreal sense to it, that estate, isn't it? Because it is just the characters in the film that you see in it.
Well, I mean, I know we talked about Naked last time. Masterpiece. Mm. I watched that again last night because my other half hadn't seen it before. And I was like, wait, okay, stop everything.
That was his
now.
Evening yeah. show, it wasn't it?
But just looking at the cinematography of it again, and it's so operatic.
Yeah.
Like, the design of it, oh, it's just gorgeous. Mm. Yeah.
Should we have a piece of music
yeah.
now
what
then?
What did we start with? We started with Sweet... Life is Sweet.
We haven't played any music
no,
yet.
No, we started with Life is Sweet.
Yeah. Life is Sweet is yeah. the first one for this week, yes?
Yes.
You still want that?
Yeah, this is Rachel Portman, isn't it?
Yes.
Yeah.
Away and here there. We go. Rachel Portman's theme for Life is Sweet there. And now we're going to move on to something to take up a big chunk of this week's show. I've gone on quite a bit over the past few months about the Parkway Cinema.
It's not like you, Martin. Sorry, I'm doing all the work.
For the Parkway Cinema, Barnsley. And get out of my cinema. And just how wonderful the place is. And I was the manager of the cinema, Rob Younger, invited me over so I could do a interview with him about the cinema and also about its capabilities. And I'm gonna have to just swap over another CD here. I spent quite a bit of the afternoon there as Rob told me all about the cinema, and you'll find out about a very special and unique feature that the cinema has, which makes it only one of three cinemas in mainland UK that can, well, do something.
Where are the other two? I don't want to jump ahead. Spoilers.
Well, yeah. I'm not going to spoil it. You'll find out. So, this is me and Rob earlier this week.
Okay, I'm sitting here with Rob Younger, the co-owner and managing director of the Parkway Cinema in Barnsley, which is Barnsley's only independent cinema. The actual cinema itself has been here since the mid-1950s, where it was first opened as the Gaumont. It then became the Odeon in 1962, I believe. And then the cinema closed in 2005. During that time, it was converted into a two-screen cinema by having the circle and the stalls made into two separate units. And in 2005, that's when Rob came to the cinema. And so could you tell us what's happened since then, Rob, please?
Yes. So my first involvement with the cinema was in 1979. So my first job from school was working here as a projectionist.
Yeah.
So I trained as a projectionist in this very building. Then I left a few years later and went back to engineering, did my qualifications and became, well, TV engineer to start with. And then I've done all sorts, but eventually became a cinema engineer. And finally, I was working as a head of technical for Picture House Cinemas across the UK.
Right.
And I was doing that job, also running Penistone Paramount up the road from 2003 to 2006. And this obviously closed in 2005. And I wanted to, I was devastated. I'm from Barnsley, I've always lived in Barnsley, I've worked all over the place, but always come back to Barnsley. And I was devastated. How can you close my cinema? I came to see the Odeon staff, many of which I knew, some of which I used to work with when I was here, they'd not left. And said, let's do something about it. Let's try and find out who's bought it. We knew someone had bought it. Anyway, they didn't. So it did close and it did get partially stripped. I then found out who the landlord was, chased him down, and finally, at the 11th hour, he said, yes, you can do something with the cinema. So at that point, I'd just taken on another one in Richmond in North Yorkshire, and I put literally all my money went into that cinema.
Yeah.
I had nothing left. And then this one came along and didn't think it would. So I approached Gerald Parks, my good friend Gerald, who's since sadly died, and we decided to go into it together. So it's we did it as a 50-50 project, myself and Gerald. And the name Parkway is because that's his company name. So it is a Parkway, but it's not part of the Parkway group. This is a separate standalone cinema.
Right.
By name only is it Parkway.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
And then it was all hands to the pumps, really. We had to paint it, we had to clean it all up, we had to really seat it, put projection kit back in, screens, everything. And it was a massive job to take on. My family and the Parks family, we all got our sleeves rolled up. I've got photographs of virtually every one of my family, my daughter, my sister, my brother, stepdaughter, stepson, we were all here. And anyway, we got it open in August 2007. We thought we'd only be here for 3 to 5 years because there was a multiplex due. And the idea was we'll just run it until that happens and then we'll close. It took 15 years for the multiplex to appear.
Response, you didn't have any cinema at all?
No, once it's closed.
During that time?
There was nothing
in
the town centre at all. The nearest one was Penistone. So when the multiplex finally did come, by that time we'd established ourselves as a little quirky independent with lots of support, and we decided that we're not going to close and walk away. It's over 2 years since the multiplex opened and we're still here, still trading.
Yeah, and I mean, I've just been here today, there's crowds of kids coming in, and you said you had over 250 seniors in for Bridget Jones this morning as well.
Not all weeks are like this, I wish they were, but this is a busy week, it's half term and we've got the three top films. So,
and unlike most cinemas, you can still show 35mm film.
Yeah. So when we reopened it, obviously there was no projection kit left in the place. I actually bought one of the original projectors that was here when I worked here in 1980 from Odeon when it closed, and I stored that under the floor at Penistone Paramount. So that came back. I brought that back. When we opened in 2007, all cinemas were still showing film. There was no digital at that time, or very little. So we reopened with two 35mm projectors, and we ran like that for 4 years, I think it was. But then digital was coming, we had to do something. So we did install digital projection in both screens, but I insisted that we kept the 35mm kit in both screens. And that kind of stemmed from my days at Picture House, because Picture House did exactly the same. When we were digitising those sites, it was very much a case of try and keep the 35mm kit capability where you can, and that's what we did. So we maintained 35mm in both screens, so we can and do still show film.
Yeah, I mean, one of the limiting things is, just, I suppose, there aren't that many films that are struck on print anymore.
But,
yeah,
but there are loads of legacy prints around, we can show a lot of the older stuff. I mean, we had a real success with Kez. We showed that from a print that was found in someone's loft, and that went down a treat. The other thing, of course, was Empire of Light. When that came out 2 years ago, that was based in an independent cinema in Margate, and it was a bit of a mock-up, but a lot of the film was shot showing it was inside a projection room, showing two projectors changing over from reel to reel like it used to be done.
And
I wanted to show it in 35mm here. We were told there was no prints available for Barnsley, they were only doing the Key Cities. So I said, Key Cities, that means by the time we get a print, it'll be wrecked, because there are no projectionists around anymore. Not most cinemas don't have projectionists.
Yeah.
So the prints, we know this, they get wrecked. I then struck a deal with the distributor and said, I'll tell you what, you find me a print, I will build and install a second 35mm projector at the side of the other one, and we'll run it on separate reels, changing from one to the other like they do on the film.
Yeah.
And the distributor said, well, that's a lot of work. I said, you said, absolute mountain of work, but you get me a print and I'll do it. And they got me a print, so I did it. It was a lot of work. We had to move the digital projector from where it was and build a second 35mm machine, and then we could run it on changeovers. And that's what we did. And that the upshot of that and other things, there was a competition run that year to find the UK cinema hero across, and it was up to anyone working in cinemas in the UK, anyone, and I won it.
I should think so. That's a job like it sounds.
And it doesn't mean one since, so I'm still officially the UK cinema hero.
But the thing is, this cinema is very unique in another way, because it's not just 35mm that you can screen, is it?
No. We can screen 70mm film as well, which is twice the width, but it's more than twice the size frame. It's a massive frame. If we can screen a print that was shot on 70mm film, the resolution is immense, because the size of the frame is huge. When that's magnified and blown up to fill the screen, there's a lot less artifacts, if you like. There's a lot less grain, a lot less everything. It's a much, much sharper picture. And this all stemmed from, in 2016, I think it was, Tarantino's The Hateful Eight.
Yes.
He shot that on 70mm, and there was one print in the UK, just one, and it was showing at Odeon Leicester Square on the opening weeks. But Picture House, my old company, had just installed 70mm capability at Picture House Central, which is basically across the other side of the square, in the Trocadero Centre. And they said, well, we want a print as well, because we've got 70mm. And the distributor said, look, really sorry, there's one print, it's going into Odeon Leicester Square, and that's it. Picture House by this point were owned by Cineworld. So Cineworld then jumped in and said, if you're not going to let us have a print for there, we won't show it in any of our sites at all. None of them. And they didn't.
Pretty much making them an offer they can't refuse.
Well, the distributor didn't back down,
yeah.
So they didn't show it. Now, I got to thinking about this, because most of the 70mm sites at that time were Picture House sites. So I installed Liverpool, was 70mm, I'm not sure if it still is. Cambridge was 70mm, that isn't anymore. Southampton, York, there was five, I can't remember where the fifth one was. There was five sites that could do it at a push. Ocean Keys, yeah, that's Southampton,
yeah.
Ocean Village. Anyway, I thought, well, it's not showing any of those sites, where's this print going to go? So I spoke to the distributor, who I knew well, he's a guy from Sheffield, and I said, right, Michael, where's this print going? And he said, well, obviously it's Leicester Square, it's going up to Edinburgh, to the Film House, and it's going over to Ireland, to the IFI. That's it. I said, well, that's a shame, isn't it? I said, can I show it in Barnsley? And he said, well, you haven't got 70mm capability. I said, if you told me I can have a print, similar story to this, we will have 70mm capability, because the projectors we had are convertible, just meant getting the parts. Anyway, again, he said, okay then. So I did the conversion, spent a lot of hours doing that, and we ran 8 for 8 in Barnsley a few weeks after release, and it was the roadshow as well, so it was a proper show.
Yeah, yeah.
And our tagline was "See the Hateful Eight in 70mm in London, Edinburgh, and Barnsley," because they were the only three towns or cities in mainland UK where you could see it.
And is that still the case now? Those three locations.
There are a few others, not so many. I mean, in London you've got Odeon Leicester Square, Picture House Central, Prince Charles, which we got on really well with the Prince Charles, BFI can show it, South Bank, and in the IMAX. That's about it for the London sites. And then coming away from London, there's no one else really doing it apart from us, Glasgow Film Theatre, and... if it reopens, Film House Edinburgh, which is... At the moment, outside London, for 70 mil, there's us and Glasgow Film Theatre in mainland UK.
That's incredible, isn't it?
Yeah.
Incredible. I saw Oppenheimer and Dune 2 last year on 70 mil, and it just looked and sounded astonishing.
It does, doesn't it?
It's an experience. It's difficult to put into words.
I mean, you know, you're watching film. You see the odd bit of dirt and the odd scratch here and there. But it's film, and to be fair, you know, cinemas were called flicks.
Yeah.
Because they inherently with a film projector, there's a little bit of flicker, because there's a thing called a flicker shutter that actually stops the light when the frame's moving from one to the other. So and I've been told this several times that it's more pleasing to the eye to see that little bit of flicker that you don't really notice than seeing a picture with the digital projectors or with a computer screen or your phone. It's never off. Whereas with a film projector, it's off virtually as long as it's on. It's off, on, off, on. It's flash, 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 flash.
Yeah, yeah.
So, yeah.
And you have a 70mm presentation that's going to be happening in less than, just over a week's time, isn't it? You're going to be screening The Brutalist.
Yes.
Which was shot in VistaVision.
Yeah.
And it's a 70mm print you're going to be showing.
Yeah.
Could you just give us a bit of background on VistaVision and how that works, projecting it in 70mm?
So VistaVision, it's the film runs horizontally through the projector, but it's the same height, the frame is the same height as a 70mm frame. It doesn't have the width, so the filmmaker who made Brutalist decided to shoot on VistaVision because he shot on 35mm film, but running horizontally. So you flip that round, and suddenly you've got a 70mm frame without the width.
Did he do that flip?
Yeah, that's done.
When it's going through the projector, the lens. You have the lens to do that.
But we don't do that because when it's processed, when it's printed. It's printed onto 70mm film that's running in a normal manner vertically through the projector. But as you said earlier, because it's VistaVision, it's not as wide as a 70mm picture would be. So it's kind of a narrower format, which you've just reminded me, actually, I need to order an aperture plate. So we've got to rejig the projector to be able to do that, because it's not set up to do that at the minute. So I've got that to do next week. And again... that film came out over a month ago now, and I said to Universal I'd like to screen it at Barnsley, and they didn't have enough prints to be able to cover Barnsley, so they've done London, and I think that's going to Glasgow after us. I think we've got it before Glasgow, but it's basically doing London here and Glasgow, that's it, and then over to Ireland again.
So you could say that's going to be the only way to see it properly.
Yeah. If you want to see it on film, on 70mm film, you go to London, you come to Barnsley, or you go to Glasgow. So we're bang in the middle.
Yeah. that's absolutely... I mean, I can't believe, you know, there is this such a unique cinema like this, just sitting here in Barnsley. And as I say, I was saying to you, this is one of my favourite cinemas. It's like going back in time, but in a nice way. You walk into the foyer, and it's not a headache of light.
No. That's what we try to be what we are, a traditional cinema.
Yeah.
And obviously we've got a multiplex across the road, which has been there over 2 years now. But we've kind of found a level. And people who want to go to a multiplex will go to a multiplex. I understand that. Some people like that, you know. Whereas people who want to come to a more traditional cinema, where staff are perhaps slightly more interested in having a chat with you and we'll talk about the film and all this kind of stuff, they'll come to us. And that's where we're at. And we know what films are going to work. I mean, Bridget Jones is working really well. The new Marvel film working not so well this week, because the Marvel film is a multiplex film. It's the young teens, the young adults, and they'll go to the multiplex to see.
Yeah, yeah.
Fully understand it. You know, it's what we expected. We could kind of predict the figures for this week. Whereas the kids' film, as you saw when you walked in, Dogman, you know, we're getting hundreds per show for that because the families with kids will come here. So it's all just for courses, really. So, but, you know, we pride ourselves. We are independent. We're totally independent. We have no support from anywhere. You know, we bought the building a couple of years ago. We own it now. And, we're proud of what we've got.
Well, Rob, thank you so much for your time. I know how busy you are and I'm dashing about here. All I can say is this place is an absolute gem, and I think more people need to know about and come here and see films, because it's... For me, this is the perfect place to come and see a film.
Thanks for that, Martin.
Thank you so much indeed.
Is that all right,
Luke? Yeah, Rob, that was all right. I was very all right. Rob Younger there telling me, and now you've heard it all, about the Parkway Cinema in Barnsley. Now, as we were saying there during that, the Brutalist is going to be showing there next weekend. Now, you're going to have to check on the cinema's website. It should be showing on Friday evening. It depends what time Rob gets the print.
There's a lot to do.
And if he's got enough time to make it up so it can actually be screened, then it's definitely going to be screened on Saturday and Sunday, with more screenings during the week after next. But please check online for the times. And it is an experience. As I say, I'm just completely in love with this place. And Rob took me in to the cinema where Dogman was screening. And it was just full of kids and parents.
Sounds like Cinema Paradiso.
And grandparents. Yeah, but before we went in, he said, "What do you smell?" And we went in and we just stood at the back. And you could see all these kids in a genuine sense of wonder. And all you could smell was popcorn. And I just teared up. And I was like, oh, going back in time for me. But it's worth a visit there a couple of times a year to see any film.
At least, yeah.
Because it's just such a beautiful place to go and see films. So, another piece of music, I think, before I need some handkerchiefs.
So, we're going to Gary Yershon now, who Mike Lee sort of worked with. He's a composer, but he worked as the musical director alongside Carl Davies on Topsy Turvy. He's basically needed an MD as well. It was so music heavy, that film. And he's worked with him as a composer ever since on most of his films. And so this is from the film that we were talking about earlier, Another Year.
Thank you.
Ah, and that was Gary Urshan with the theme from Another Year, our third Mike Lee song of the show. Reviews. Well, we've got to catch up on a review, haven't we? And it's a bit late with this one because I think most of the UK that wants to see it has seen it.
Probably seen it.
But Rob mentioned it in the interview there.
Yeah.
Bridget Jones.
It's mad doing about the boy. Great guns, apparently.
It's breaking box office records. And then in brackets, for a rom com.
Can you make it any more niche?
It does show you that there is a desire out there for these films and stories about older women as well, not just the 20 something. Now, on paper, I shouldn't like Bridget Jones, really. She's quite well off. She's you know, she's in the London media set. You know, it's a British film.
Living on the front line.
And yet I cannot count the amount of times I have watched and enjoyed the first Bridget Jones film. It's just a comfort thing that I really like. And I used to read I read the Independent column.
The columns, yes, yeah, yeah.
That Helen Fielding wrote, and that I read the book before I saw the film. So I was predisposed to enjoy it, I think. Bridget Jones Mad About the Boy, we catch up with Bridget in her 50s. She's widowed. She lost the love of her life, Mark Darcy. We know he's the love of her life because she figured out in the three films before that he was the love of her life. He's dead. There is no sort of realism in this film when it comes to, she's got this lovely, massive London house. I know he was a human rights lawyer and everything. He's got loads of money.
I've never seen one. I remember seeing in the trailer for one of the early ones, she had this flat that was above Borough Market.
Well, yeah, I mean, and it was a bit rough then, but yeah.
They roughed it up.
I don't think anyone else goes to see Bridget Jones to see what the reality is like living as a widow financially.
I get your point. She only goes
back to work because of a very amusing scene with Emma Thompson, who plays a gynaecologist. She turned up in the third film as a gynaecologist, but she goes to see her all the time as a doctor now because it's Emma Thompson and we want some Emma Thompson scenes. Fine, I'm fine with that. She only goes back to work because Emma Thompson says, look, you're bored, go back to work. You need to do that. She's a TV producer on like one of these daytime shows, women shows. She falls for a younger man. And the choice is between this younger man and the boring teacher. There's no prizes for guessing where it ends up, but it's just very, very moving along the way. I cried buckets, Martin. I absolutely cried buckets.
Do you want to hang over me now? I really did. Because these films are designed to, and that's, yeah. And that's entirely part of their appeal. I wasn't saying that in a negative way at all.
And the cast obviously have fun. Daniel Cleaver, Hugh Grant is back as Daniel Cleaver, back from the dead. And he obviously is having a great time as the dirty uncle figure now in the family. It's a very, very, very enjoyable film. It works really well. And I saw Peter Bradshaw's poo-pooing review of like 2 or 3 stars. And I was like, well, I don't really care what Peter Bradshaw thinks about this.
Well, you said it was Peter, it's not for you.
It's not for you, yeah. And it's not going to be. If you're not interested, don't bother. It's fine.
Which is what I wouldn't. Do you want to see me Ronnie Zellweger impersonation?
Is it for radio? Reader, Martin's left and Rennie Zellweger's with us on the show.
You thought that was her, didn't you, for a moment? You thought it was her.
There's loads of references as well to all the earlier films, especially some wardrobe references in what she's wearing. It's really funny. And there's a bit where Leo Woodhull, the young man, dives into the water to the tune of Mad About the Boy. And it is a straight rip-off of the Mr. Darcy scene in Pride and Prejudice, the TV version. From 1995. It's a lot of fun. I had a lot of fun. Highly rate. Much better than the third one. If you like your Bridget Jones, my Bridget Jones order is now film 1, film 4, film 2, film 3.
And there you have it. Yeah. And I'm sure film five won't be that far from coming down.
No, I think,
coming down
like
the track.
It feels like a close. It feels like a close as well.
We've felt that a lot of times. Yeah. Haven't we? Oh, that's it. Okay, our other film for this week is the Brazilian film I'm Still Here, which is in the running for Oscars for Best Film, Best Director and Best Lead Actress, I believe.
She is a good lead actress.
And the lead actress is Fernanda Torres, who is, I haven't seen her much, but she's a huge star in Brazil and the Portuguese-speaking world. So this is a film that starts off in the 1970s in Brazil under the military dictatorship. And for the first part of the film, we're introduced to this family, the Paiva family. Five children, husband and wife, who lead a fairly idyllic, happy experience in a beachfront house in Rio de Janeiro. And as the film progresses, things start to become darker. There's more soldiers on the streets, helicopters forever hovering. And it leads to one evening, whether they're the police, the army, or a secret police, come in, abduct her husband, and, well, we never see him again. And for the rest of the film, it's about the wife, played by Fernanda Torres, her fight. Well, first of all, to get even recognised that her husband has been taken, and then to try and find out where her husband is.
But it's interesting that you say fight, because she has to keep it so low key, doesn't she?
It's like trying to do this, but doing it in the most inconsequential, because the last thing you want to do is draw attention to yourself.
Because you know where she knows.
Well,
where
she actually she's actually taken away along with one of her daughters and is questioned quite intensively and brutally about her husband's activities. So, as a film, I thought it was really good up until about two thirds of the way through. And I think you were saying sort of something like the same. And as you're like talking about the film itself, it just seemed to run out of steam a bit. You got to a point, well, there's not much else they can do, but just
I was thinking about this. It was strangely uninvolving at the I don't want to spoil it by saying what part of the narrative it was, but
That third act for me, I thought, well, everything's over by the end of the second act, it seems. And that, those two thirds, I think, are brilliant. But then, it, as you say, it's like run out of steam a bit. But Fernanda Torres is absolutely, I thought, astonishing. Mm. And she gets my vote for the Oscar for her best leading actress. And it's well worth going to see, I would say, you know.
And we were talking about as well the importance of like photography in it. And
photographs are key to everything in the way the film's framed. Mm. There's lots of scenes of the family at the beginning taking photographs, and these photographs turn up.
And of course, these are real people.
Later in the film, it's a true. And then we see the actual photographs that the photographs in the film are based on the end credits. And there's also, when her daughter goes to England, she communicates through 8mm cine films, photographs, and then on a much darker side, when she is arrested, she is continually having to look through pages and pages of photos of people who have been taken by the police and the army and are, well, apparently in custody, or quite often perhaps already dead. So it's a great device to sort of take you through the film. But as I say, Fernanda Torres, she gets my vote for... Is it next weekend? What happens?
Well, the Oscars? Yeah. No, it's not for a while yet.
Is it? Oh, they've got time then. Yeah. They've got time to vote in for it. Okay, so next...
You hear a bit of Secrets and Lies.
Okay.
I'm standing in the middle and I can't take it anymore.
Thank you.
We're back, and well, God, we've had so much in this show today that we may have to scratch our final piece of music. But for next week, there's a couple of bits and pieces.
Well, the last Showgirls out, isn't it? So that's Gia Coppola's film.
Yes, I saw that the other week, but I'm not going to tell you about it until next week.
There's a little bit of David Lynch going on around the place. Eraserhead's showing today and Sunday and Wednesday at the Light. And
that's a great date movie, anyone, if you're thinking of...
Well, it's part of a season they're doing with Elephant Man, Wild at Heart and Blue Velvet coming up in future as well. And the showroom's got some short films of David Lynch on, if you want to catch that too.
Yes, he's a very, very early works. I don't know, are they including any of his adverts or anything? Or any of the Rabbits
the
films?
The Alphabet is one of them.
Oh, that's one of really... The Grandmother, yeah. They're all, I think...
And The Amputee, I think, is another one.
I think they're all pre-Eraserhead. Also, Curzon have a Brief Encounter on again next Tuesday. If you fancy...
I've got something in my eye.
So you have. Get out of my way, woman. Could you make me a coffee? That's on 11:30 in the morning, next Tuesday morning. What a way to spend a Tuesday morning. What's her name? Dottie Lasseter or something, that horrible woman who's always breaks in when they're just about to have a moment.
Behind the tea urn.
Leave it.
Oh, no, the friend. Yeah. Okay.
Get out of my calf. So there's that for you. Next week we'll be back. We've got some other stuff we haven't had time for this week. A couple of sad losses with Genevieve Page, who passed away at the ripe age of 97. We're talking a bit more about her next week. And the big news that dropped this week about Amazon paying $1 billion to take up the Bond franchise, which is causing a bit of a stink with Bond fans. I think it could well mean that we'll have an American playing James Bond next time it reaches the screen.
My name is Bond.
Jimmy Bond, yeah. but we're just talking out to 1 o'clock here because we haven't got time. But we will be back next week. Have a great week. Enjoy your films and...